And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Hello, everyone. It's Martin Willis, your host. Welcome to Podcast UFO. We have a great show for you this evening. A friend of mine, Peter Robbins, is going to be on. He's always entertaining. And we're going to be talking a little bit about this amazing Russian close encounter that happened back in 1989. Very, very interesting and just kind of out of this world, you know, 9-foot creatures and all that. Really, really interesting. Out of this world, I guess you'd call that a pun. Anyway, Alejandro Rojas will be coming up in just a minute with UFO Updates Live. And I want to thank you for supporting the show. You can support the show for a couple of dollars or more a month. That information's on podcastufo.com. I noticed we're getting a lot of downloads on our free shows because I can see it now, see how many there are. And pretty impressive. And you can help us out for just a couple of dollars. Keep that in mind. If you can't, you can listen to the full show always on YouTube Live or on Podcast UFO Live. It's going to be for this week and next week from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Then it's going back to the regular slot of 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can also listen to the full show. Full show on the Dark Matter Digital Network. And that's every Thursday evening. And that's at 10 to midnight. And so that's it for me for now. Alejandro, what's going on?
Not a whole lot, you know. UFOs are going on. I shouldn't say that. There's a lot of good stories out there. But the first thing we have to do, I think, is go through our weekly list of apologies. Because we seem to be offending a lot of people lately. We offended the entire country of Canada last week, apparently. No, actually, it was just one person. Hopefully, we didn't offend everybody. But I do want to say I apologize for my ignorance about Canada Day. It apparently is on the 1st, but that UFO sighting we talked about said they were celebrating it on the 2nd, which is their right to do. And, of course, we were teasing the Canadians about stealing our thunder and you know, choosing July 1st a few days before July 4th. So when July 4th comes around, they could be like, we already partied, man. You guys are behind the times. But, yeah, someone got a little upset about that. So I guess we were just having fun. And, of course, I love Canadians. We talk a lot about good stuff about Canadians, don't we?
We certainly actually do, yes.
Stanton, of course, is out there. Grant Cameron is a Canadian. We love Canadians. I had a Canadian on my show recently who from Vancouver who's got this documentary called Nocturnal Lights, made in Canada for the most part, which people have to check out. In fact, I think your guest might from today might even be in it, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, Charles Lamoureux was his name, and go Canada. Just wanted to say that. And don't worry, if you are wondering, hey, how come he's not apologizing for something he said about me and the region that I live? Don't worry, I'm sure, just give it some time, and we'll make some sort of... Yeah.
Guaranteed, yeah. Well, you know, that's fine. You know, we have, like you said, there's a lot of great people, and you and I were on Bonaparte, so what's his first... trying to remember his first name. Jordan,
I think it's Jason.
Jordan. Jordan Bonaparte. So we were on his show up in Canada together, you and I. And I'm actually heading up there to Shag Harbor in October on the anniversary. I'm really excited to do that. That should be a lot of fun.
Cool.
Yeah. So what's going on?
That should be fun.
Yeah, it will be. So what's going on in the UFO news currently?
Yeah, so we have some cool sightings that Roger Marsh. Well, I was one of them. One I found. I think these were both. These are both from Roger. But of course, he's the director of communications for MUFON, and he posts some cool sightings on our site on a regular basis. And we have a couple cool ones here. First of all, from just the other day, and I love this one. This is an aviation mechanic who is unable to identify a sphere-shaped object. This was in Ohio, in Mahoning County. And the reason I giggled a little bit is because this guy was cruising his scooter, which is cool. Of course, Arizona, we've got warm weather. We've got a lot of people, these older retirees, on their scooters cruising around. And at least this is the first time I can remember a UFO sighting from a scooter, which is kind of cool. Those guys are scooting around quite a bit. So, you know, if you are scooting around right now while you're listening to this podcast, keep your eyes to the sky. You may see something strange like this gentleman. So anyway, this was on at about 10 p.m. on June 10th. Although, I don't know, scooting at night might be dangerous, but so be careful out there. But this guy says he went, when he saw this thing, he went to grab his cell phone charger out of his scooter, or no, he went to go grab his cell phone charger out of his scooter, and when he saw this object that he took a picture of and got a little bit of video, but he says that he worked on F-16s. He has knowledge of planes and helicopters and falling space objects, but he was not able to identify what this object is. We do have the pictures. He says to him it looks sphere-shaped. In the pictures, it looks more like an elongated object. But, yeah, it's not readily apparent what it is. And, of course, this person has experience with looking at aircraft, and he couldn't identify it. So it's an interesting one. It's being investigated by Joseph Pavlansky for Ohio MUFON right now. So we'll see what they figure out there. But that's kind of a cool one. You saw that, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think it's a really interesting one.
Mm-hmm. And then another interesting one where there were at least a couple witnesses was a gentleman in California, Landers, California. That's another town name that for some reason makes me laugh. I guess it's because I think of Flanders. The Flanders, you know, in the Simpsons, of course, funny people.
Yeah.
We're going to get emails from Landers now saying,
we're not more all hate like the mail. Flanders.
But this is an interesting one because this this gentleman says he believes, you know, this aircraft or this object was being chased by a jet, and this was seen during a UFO conference in the Joshua Tree area. So this happened on May 21st. It was also about 10 p.m. The video, they did capture some video, and it was with night vision goggles, and in the video you do see two sets of lights. You see one set behind another. The first set has, you know, the lights are consistent. They're on. The second set are blinking, so you can tell it's an aircraft. The witnesses, of which there were quite a few, said that they could hear the jet noise, you know, so they knew that there was a jet. I guess there were about 50 people out there looking for UFOs when they saw this. Somebody had a pair of night vision goggles, and they said they felt that they could tell what the shape of the object is and that it was diamond-shaped. A lot of people, though, you know, when you hear that diamond shape, it often triggers this kind of red flag, which is just that. Often the aperture in cameras is diamond-shaped, and a bright light kind of fills is so strong that it takes the shape of the aperture. So that's a possibility. People who know more about this equipment know better than I could probably make some more educated comments on that. So that's possibly why she saw a diamond shape. But so this is an interesting sighting. I know the person investigating this is Earl Gray Anderson. So he's a cool dude. He is in our Open Minds UFO news forum quite a bit. And commenting, so really good guy, Earl Gray, out there in California. And I love his name because it harkens back to, of course, Jean-Luc Picard, another name I like to say. Is that, of course, it sounds French. Maybe he's French-Canadian, Jean-Luc Picard. But
I should
drink Earl Gray tea.
I know. I was feeling like I should get up and get some tea right now. But
yeah, you should. In honor of Earl Gray, maybe he's even listening. So a really neat guy out of California. He's investigating. He is a little bit wary, he says, though, because We have seen from this conference other pictures and videos of alleged objects and beings that do not pan out. So especially at this conference, there's kind of a frenzy, you know, where people are talking about UFOs and aliens. So people want to see UFO and aliens, and it seems like they have misidentified some pictures and images in the past. So he's a little worried that maybe this kind of you know, need or frenzy to see something weird has influenced their opinions. But yeah, he's looking into it, and we'll see what he discovers.
Hey, Alejandro, we have a lot of people up in the chat room, and one just posed a quick question for you. They wanted to know if there was any possibility of ordering back issues of the, you know, the UFO magazine. Opens Mind.
Oh, is that a real chatter?
Oh, yes.
That's awesome. That's like set spike, you know, perfect. They're setting me up to promo the magazines. Yes. And I love that question because our magazines, I love our magazines so much. In fact, behind me, and maybe that's what triggered that thought, you can see some of our posters of our magazine covers. In fact, this one here is written by Ryan Sprague, and he references your guest a lot in the article he wrote in this particular issue. But anyway,
wait a minute, before you go any further, Ryan is giving a shout out as we speak on the chat room.
Really?
How about that?
He's a cool dude.
He is.
Love that guy.
And he loves that you call him Sprague, too.
Oh, I keep saying it wrong. Dang
it.
He corrected me last time he was on my show.
Sprague.
Sprague. Oh, I'm sorry.
No problem. Oh, he likes that.
But I guess I shouldn't worry. People mispronounce my name a lot, and I don't mind. But anyway. Yes, you can go to openminds.tv, click on the shop link, and you'll be able to order some videos. Sorry, I paused there because I just got fired from Peter Robbins.
I saw that.
You're fired. He's very upset about me mispronouncing his good buddy's, his little buddy's name there. But yeah, you can go to openminds.tv, and you can order back orders. We're out of like about the first six magazines. However, we do post stories online from the magazine, and I'll continue to do that and do that more often so that people can still get that content, because we had a lot of great contributors like Ryan who wrote some great stories, and I like to get that information out there because that's the whole point. But the magazine is beautiful. Eric McFarlane did the artwork for the most part, and he's just a genius in my eyes. He does most of the artwork for Open Minds in the UFO Congress. But yes, you can get those magazines at openminds.tv. We have a shop there, a link for that, and check those out.
Uh-huh. Alejandro, now that you're just going to be able to do this live for just a couple of weeks and we have to go back to pre-recording, but... You know, I got to tell you, I want to thank all the people that have been involved in these YouTube videos. Since I've been in Russia now for this very long time, I've noticed that more people are watching this show, but it's, you know, mostly in the UK and throughout Europe, more people watching this show live than ever, than it is in my regular time slot.
That is so cool.
Yeah, and I don't know, my regular listeners may not want to hear this, but I may consider changing the time slot a little just to try to get more people in.
Well, I'm sure you'll get some feedback having given that comment.
I'm sure I will. All right, anything else going on?
No, I think that's about it. Otherwise, let's see, in the regular headlines, we're posting headlines on a regular basis about UFOs, and there are quite a few UFO stories in the mainstream news, so I think people should check that out. There's a lot going on out there, so it's pretty cool.
All right, and while Ryan's here, I just want to say, Ryan, Ryan runs a great show, a really good podcast. It's really become quite a success. It's called SomewhereInTheSkies.com, and SomewhereInTheSkies.com, you can see it. And also, he has a book, a very interesting book. He's been on the show recently. So, Alejandro, thank you so much.
Thank you, my friend.
All right, and we will be chatting to you next week. Somehow you just went off the screen here, so let me figure out what's going on, and I'll talk to you next week, Alejandro.
All right, talk to you later.
All right. Okay, everyone, so now we're going to be bringing in our guest, Peter Robbins. And Peter is an amazing artist, first of all, but he's been involved in the UFO topic for a very long time. He's been doing lectures all over the world, actually. And tonight we're going to be talking about the Verona's incident, Close Encounter. It's really incredible, plus a bunch of other things. So, Peter, I want to welcome you to the show. How are you?
Good, Martin, and it's great to be back.
Yes. Let me just try to adjust what's going on here. There you are. All right. Yes, I know. It's been a while since you've been on the show, hasn't it? I'm trying to remember.
I don't know, 1943 or 4, I think.
I think it was just before the big UFO flap that started in 47, if I got that right. But no. So for the person who has not heard you before, Peter, can you just give a quick background about yourself?
Yeah, I'm an investigative writer who specializes in the subject of UFOs. Have been obsessed to interested in the subject for about 40 years, beginning with a memory returned some years ago of a childhood sighting I had with one of my sisters, and make it my business to do the best I can to research, investigate, and write about the subject. More often than not, though, not the the hottest, sexiest, most exotic cases, but ones with real roots in post-war history. I guess I see my role in this, having developed over the decades, more as somebody who focuses in on trying to get reasonable thinking and skeptical thinking, well-educated, open-minded people, or whatever level of education, through that first door, to take a serious look at the subject, to a degree to get clear of the ridicule factor, which is a particular interest of mine, how the subject of seeing something in the sky that you couldn't identify has become internationally wired up with delusion, hoaxing, mysticism, and everything that it has nothing to do with. And this past month, I've been lucky enough in my work to travel to Athens, Greece, along with my good friend and close colleague Richard Dolan, to speak at a Wilhelm Reich conference that focused in on the UFO subject. And then just a few weeks ago in Roswell, New Mexico, to speak at one of the three conferences going on there for the 70th anniversary. Here I am back home again, just outside of Ithaca, New York, in a beautiful part of rural New York State.
Now, Peter, when you and I first met, I want to say it was back in 2011. You were up in Maine at the Experience to Speak. It was a little town in Maine, like Gorham, Maine, I want to say it was. So we first met, and I remember you telling me the story about you and your sister sighting the silvery discs or something like that. Can you go over that sighting? Because I remember it. There was more than one, right? There was a number of objects.
Yeah. We were basically just kids goofing around on the front lawn on a late spring or early summer, late morning. Not a cloud in the sky. I grew up in New York City, lived most of my life there, but really came of age in a very pretty little village called Rockville Center, about 30 miles east of Manhattan. And we were playing on the front lawn, and I caught something out of my right peripheral vision, and either said, "Look," or my sister's name, Helen, and she looked up, and coming in at a very high rate of speed and then stopping stock still were five silvery white disc-shaped objects, all tipped at the same angle, so they appeared like ellipses, like a dinner plate would if you held it at an angle. There was no ambiguity to them, Martin. They were disc-shaped, no appendages whatsoever, and in a very precise V-type formation. Also, close enough that we could both make out regular off-color detail around the edge of each that when we compared notes on it many years later, because I made it the repressed memory of my childhood. If I have another one, I don't remember. And they looked like windows on a commercial airliner at an appreciable distance. And we looked and looked and looked. This was a very different time. I had a ridiculously innocent childhood. At that age in adolescence, I was a Boy Scout. Major passions included collecting rocks and bugs and stamps and fossils. The only resonance that the subject of UFOs, or as they were called more often back then in the 60s, flying saucers, had for me was on Saturday, sometimes going to our local movie theater with some of my buddies and having fun, or, you know, getting fake scared at some of the great B movies, always almost all in black and white. But I think, in so many words, the adult notion was simply something that I had assimilated, probably like a lot of young people at the time. I just never gave them a thought. They had nothing to do with my interests or my life, and yet there they were. And it was a shattering experience for me, in that I tried as well as I could to rationalize what I was seeing. And in the many years that I've done investigatory work, and for many of those years working as Bud Hopkins' assistant, Bud being arguably the father of scientific abduction-related studies, perhaps the most complex and challenging area of UFO studies, I had the privilege of working with him on literally hundreds of investigations with quite a few hundred individuals who alleged to have had these kinds of experiences. And I spoke to many people that went through similar reactions when they had an initial or their initial UFO sighting or experience. I call it the checklist response, where you look up and you see a thing or things that are completely out of your understanding, and your rational mind goes, planes, helicopters, blimps, balloons, reflections from the ground, flotsam and jetsam, birds, weird shaped clouds. And then you hit the wall, and that's what happened to me. So much so, and I think that a big part of my repressing the memory was I was at that time being run by wanting to be a cooler kid instead of a very short, bespectacled, geeky nerd kid. I was starting to think a lot about this thing called sex, and I knew enough about girls to know if I were to tell any girl I knew about this, every girl in the world would soon learn about it, and this thing called sex would probably never be open to me. And I'm only half kidding. I mean, these were the things that were driving me to repress this memory. And in a matter of weeks, I had, and it was more than 14 years before that memory came roaring back into my mind and, to put it mildly, changed my life overnight.
Wow. Yeah, that is something else that I have heard of, people repressing them. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine in the antiques business basically stumbled on my website, and he had repressed his memory of a youth. He was telling me about it, and it was he was walking with some buddies, and an object came over him, and they all looked up at it, and they felt like the thing was either controlling them, or they felt like the thing was angry. He didn't know how else to explain it. Like there were feelings coming down. And so him and his buddies all just stood there, and they decided they weren't going to look up again. And then they finally did. But he repressed that for years. And it just came out, like, I don't know, something he watched on TV or something, and bang, there it was. So I think, when people talk about abductions, you mentioned it earlier that, you know, people are repressing, and I think more on that than probably encounters.
Well, yes and no. Part of the mythology is people who have had these experiences, and make no mistake to anybody in your audience, these things happen, and they happen to more people than any of us would be comfortable with if we had hard statistics on it. Many of the people who approached Bud Hopkins in those many years that I worked with them, and obviously otherwise, had their memories intact or had partial memories. A percentage had a free-floating anxiety that was triggered by any number of what we would call presenting signs, any one, two, or five on their own, not necessarily indicative, but if it's like 15 different things that, you know, came together as a profile over the years of working with these folks, then the chances were serious that perhaps they had had an experience like this.
Now, one of the things I set off the bat, or I've been telling everyone, because since I'm in Russia, and I'm only going to be here one more week, this is the fifth week going to be here. It's been 6 weeks, a long time to be here. Voronezh, is that how you pronounce that? And I should know.
I believe it's Voronezh.
Voronezh. And so, you know, I could probably, believe it or not, I've been learning Cyrillic. I could probably pronounce it better if it was in that.
You know, and I take that back. It also, I've heard it pronounced Voronezh.
Voronezh.
So, yes, you will have to find out for us how Russians pronounce it.
Yeah, I'm going to look while we're here. And so let's talk about that. And I want to tell you, though, I've talked to about 10 or 15 people here, and no one remembers it. I was thinking, for sure. Now, I'm to the south of Moscow by about 800 or 1,000 miles. And I know this was 200 miles away or so from Moscow. So, but this thing hit worldwide news. So,
yes.
This to me, I heard about this sighting when I first started really looking seriously into this topic, and it's always fascinated me. I was really excited when you said you were looking into this and revisiting it. So,
yeah.
For the person that's never heard about this incident, why don't you go through the whole thing?
Yeah, first, I think it's fascinating that the people that you've been in contact with, obviously some who are involved in this subject, did not have a recall of it. I think there's actually a really good reason for that. It happened in the autumn of 1989, and the coverage, the research and investigation bridged from that time into 1991. That is, if you superimpose it on what was going on in world history at that time, it is literally a perfect match for the complete disintegration of the Soviet Union. In fact, I kept a separate notebook. I was just fascinated with this long moment in history, growing up as a Cold War kid, and how literally this whole communist experiment was dying before our eyes. I think part of the American mythology is because Ronald Reagan made it happen. I think if you look closer, you will see that essentially the premier and then the first president of the Soviet of Russia, Mikhail Gorbachev, one of the most fascinating individuals of the 20th century, I think, he basically walked away from the game. He ran the numbers. They couldn't afford to continue doing what they were doing. And so the Soviet Union fell. And even for people who might have had an interest, your average Soviet citizen slash going into Russian citizen at that time, this was not the most important thing going on in your life, even though it was a major event. The story broke here in America on October 9th. My treatment of the story actually becomes a very personal one because of how deeply I became involved with one of the leading Soviet and then Russian researchers, and developed a very close friendship with a great deal of correspondence back and forth, that if things had been set back a year and a half or 2 years, I don't think most of our communications would have gotten back and forth to each other. We were writing letters and nothing else, and sending packages to each other with books and, you know, gifts and this kind of thing. It is, in the world of anomalies that ufology represents, this is one of the most anomalous UFO events on record. It literally is so different than just about any other really credible one that it is in something of a place by itself. The story first was broken by TASS, the Soviet news agency. This did not come through the equivalent of a tabloid. There weren't any in the Soviet Union at the time. This was a story that came through the official Soviet news agency, the specifics of which were backed by the Soviet government. Now, a conspiracy-minded or a suspicious mind might immediately say, this must have been some kind of propaganda thing, you know, or some kind of psyops or test to see how folks in the Soviet Union and outside would react. But there were too many credible witnesses. And interestingly, like the very important Zimbabwe case that the late Dr. John Mack did so much to investigate, a good portion of the witnesses were children. School had just gotten out. The basics of it are that a craft was seen to come in over a park. It came and went, and then it landed in a tree. A creature came down, a robot kind of creature came down. Their descriptions match literally nothing that we have seen before. They walked through the park. At a certain point, a boy made a noise, and much like the wonderful science fiction robot from The Day the Earth Stood Still, Gort, a beam came out of the part of its head, and the boy disappeared. The boy disappeared. And when they went back up into the craft, he reappeared. This is the most basic part of it. There was a landing on the ground. It left traces with radioactivity in the soil. I guess one of the things that caught my attention most was that even though it had happened in September, it took several weeks for the story to make its way into TASS and, of course, be released that way. Where it became personal for me was on that afternoon. I was living in an apartment on West 57th Street in Manhattan. And as was my habit at the time, I often had the TV news on in the background instead of music, as some people might. I'm a bit of a news junkie, and was working away. And the first report started to come on the news. And I slapped in a video cassette, and that dates the event, and then just started to go back and forth between the news stations. Cable news was still fairly new. But it was one report after another. And I thought to myself, the TASS News Agency, they have their American headquarters in Rockefeller Center. I walked by their office regularly. And I thought, maybe I can get in there somehow. And I cold called the TASS News Agency and put on my best grown-up voice, said I was a investigative writer who lived in Manhattan, and was very interested in the story that was breaking right then and there. And that as an American of Russian ancestry, which I am, I wondered if there was any chance that there was anybody at TASS that I could talk to about this. And whoever I was on the phone with, I could literally hear people in the background with a lot of excitement. I mean, it was happening right then and there. And he invited me over. And it's not a long walk. And less than an hour later, I was in the offices of TASS. I brought them some, you know, official declassified, fully available documents to kind of impress upon them that I was serious in the subject. And as telexes were coming off their telex machines and being ripped off and looked at, I asked if I might have copies of them. And when I left there about an hour later, with great goodwill from these people that work there, and mine back to them, I walked out with, you know, all of the breaking news as it was coming out of their printers. Some months later, through a friend of mine who happens to be a psychotherapist and very involved in the work of Dr. Wilhelm Reich, in fact, she was at the time the editor of the twice-a-year major American Reich Journal, she had received a request from a Soviet professor asking for a copy of their journal and sending along a copy of the first edition of a book that he and colleagues had rushed into print. And she said, I think you're the person to contact him. I did. His name is Yuri Lotsotsev, and we began at first a very businesslike correspondence that over the next 2 years became a very personal one, with him translating a lot of what was in the book for me, because it's only come out in Russian. Sent me a later edition of the book as well, unfortunately, which I've never been able to read. It has only never come out in English. And that was how I got involved in the case. But the secondary story, which is very important, or should be, to Americans involved in the subject, is how incredibly cavalier major American news coverage was of this event. And they obsessed about it, led by the New York Times, which had more coverage on the Voronezh incident in 1989 and 1990 than it had ever given over to any single UFO incident since 1952 and the overflights over Washington, D.C. And so I immediately began to collect all the coverage I could from every major and regional newspaper that I could. And once again, that pattern of condescension, sarcasm, innuendo, mm-hmm. every kind of pseudo-pseudoscience imaginable, and how the rationales arced as the Soviet Union went into its deadly nosedive. One of the most dismissive and fascinating theories that the American press put forward was, you know, these poor Russian people and the Russian republics, of course, the Soviet republics, had been living for more than 70 years under the heel of repressive communism, but at heart they were mystical, you know, Greek Orthodox Catholics who longed to recontact with all of their, you know, mystical heritage, and that, of course, we should expect in this moment where freedom of the press was starting to open up, that we would see wild exaggerations and the like, which was, I thought, very insulting to the witnesses that had the courage to come forward, no matter how outlandish the specifics of the case seemed to be to the press mm-hmm. in America. They were very well documented, and I think I obviously felt strongly enough that it was a case worth reinvestigating that I did just that. And in fact, the paper that I gave in June last month at the Contact with Space conference in Athens, Greece, was on Voronezh.
And you are pronouncing that right. I looked at the Cyrillic. So, Peter, this first of all, one of the accounts that I either read or I watched something maybe on this said that it was not the beam that came out of his head, but something, a stick or something the figure held in its hand and waved at the boy that disappeared. So maybe there's some there's misrepresentation there out. If that's different.
I don't
even
think misrepresentation as much as when you have an incident, be it paranormal or normal. Let's compare it to you're minding your own business in an urban area and you hear a terrible sound, and you actually see the except for the first second, a automobile crash. Two cars coming together, people being hurt, you know, a terrible sound. The physiology of human shock, auditory exclusion, tunnel vision, epinephrine and adrenaline dumps into the body cause variances in human memory. And again, I use car crash because that's the classic example of when you see police reports of an accident, it's almost inevitable that quote-unquote witnesses are going to report having seen different nuances of the same thing. The car was green. No, it was blue-green. You know, it came out of, in this case, the forehead or a stick that the being was holding. Mm-hmm. Some of these questions will probably never have answered. And what I should probably do, Martin, is after the show, send you a copy of a paper that I've written on this that you can post on your website.
Sure.
And that your listeners can review for themselves.
Yes, certainly. So the listener who's listening to the podcast, this will be in the show notes if you want to check that out. So, Peter, one of the first questions that comes to mind is the boy that disappeared and reappeared. What did he have to say about that particular experience?
Absolutely nothing that was recorded. Many of these children, you know, they made their initial reports, and then they're still living in the Soviet Union. Parents did not allow them to comment further. To draw attention to yourself on something so controversial mm-hmm. in a totalitarian state mm-hmm. is probably not a good idea to start with. So there are accounts that we have initial aspects of the accounts, and then when Yuri and his research team chased down many of the individuals, they had, quote-unquote, nothing to add. And maybe they even were concerned about what they had said initially. But again, there were enough credible accounts to suggest to me that not only were these people not interested in attention, anything but, nobody was interested in writing a book or becoming a celebrity about this, anything but in this kind of situation, that there was no motivation to lie to investigators. Again, mm-hmm. this thing of wanting to feel special, that's one of my favorite Phil Klass rationales for people who come forward with a UFO story. Well, please, there are ways to feel special that will draw less ire or less joking at your expense, to put it mildly.
Mm-hmm. By the way, earlier you said, when I was mentioning that no one had heard about this, I have not really spoken to anyone in the UFO field out here. So perhaps people in the field would know that.
I would imagine because it is. It's not Roswell, but in the same way that the Rendlesham incident in the UK from 1980, the press in Britain sometimes referred to it as Britain's Roswell, has nothing to do with any similarities in the case, just that it's their most famous case. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure, I would imagine in the UFO research community in, you know, Greater Russia and the old republics, that it would certainly be a case that is known and studied, and that a number of books have been written on, not just UFOs and Voronezh, the book that I have copies of.
Now, has anyone followed these children, and as far as being able to get in touch with them these days or any time shortly after that?
Not to the best of my knowledge. And when I was last in touch with Yuri, and that's 1993 now, again, this happened in 1989, we began to correspond either late 89 or early 90, no. Again, we have to remember that there were historic earth-shaking events going on behind this mm-hmm. at the time.
Right.
And a paranormal incident compared to the entire collapse of an empire, because that's what we're talking about here.
Yes.
It's not the same. And again, this is very unlike the follow-up work that has been done with many of the child witnesses in the Zimbabwe case.
Right.
That for me is also that is in a class by itself. Mm-hmm. In the last years, since Mac is since he was killed by a drunken driver in England in 2004, loss ufology in the States still has some getting over to do. Researchers have been able to interview a good number of these people who are now young adults or adults in no uncertain terms, and every single one of them stands by their original accounts and in no uncertain terms.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's I wonder how things would be different today if that happened. First of all, you have the iPhone even here. you have internet, it's more free. I have been talking to people here about what had changed when it used to be communism.
Sure.
They, you know, the one thing that everybody says is it was very, very controlled. Everything was very controlled.
Of course.
And punishment, you could get punished for about anything. And
I think the answer to your question is everything would have been different about this event. The reportage around it, the overt curiosity rather than covert curiosity. And as you mentioned, I would guess that if it happened now, almost everybody in that park would have their smartphones out and be filming the hell out of this. There wouldn't be any question. The American press wouldn't have a leg to stand on to dish on it on the level that they did. And it was scathing and insulting and demeaning. This would have been a huge difference. Those images could have gone right up on the internet. And although it is a very double-edged sword to rely on internet sources for your UFO-related information, this would have been one of those cases where credible videographer, film analysts, people like Dr. Bruce Maccabee, who was for so many years the go-to guy relative to UFO analysis, film analysis, and now Mark D'Angelo, my dear friend. D'Antonio, who is now, I believe, MUFON's official film analyst.
Yes.
A brilliant scientist and, for me, a very singular personality in the work. Validation for the images would have come in very quickly. And because it, you know, it's, I will be generous and say I think that it is a somewhat corrupt government, but it is a freewheeling and open government in its own way that, you know, repressing a UFO story under Putin, I don't think it would really happen or not happen in a way that would, you know, make it verboten or something that people were locked up for or warned against. It'd be out there. It'd be out there. It'd be discussed by folks like the ones that you're mixing with on a regular basis. It would not be confined to the so-called UFO research community in Russia, anything but, if it happened now.
Now, weren't there sightings, quite a few sightings around there right after this or right before it as well?
There were follow-ups and there were reports of earlier ones. In January of 1990, the legendary Dr. Jacques Vallée, certainly one of the most respected people in the history of UFO research, who does not take, to put it mildly, a strictly extraterrestrial explanation. He has always been one of our freest and most open-minded thinkers. He met with, he was in the Soviet Union at the time, and he met with members of the research community in Voronezh. And he had said, in fact, that the sightings that were happening on both of Voronezh in the Soviet Union were part of a worldwide wave of UFO visitations, and he characterized it as the largest one that he was aware of that had happened in the past decade.
Wow. Wow, yeah. Now, you were saying revisited. How are you revisiting? In what way? Are you doing research? I know I haven't read your paper, but are you doing research when it comes to looking at old reports of this worldwide, or how are you doing that?
Yeah. Essentially, what I've done has been to pull together all of the mainstream coverage that was reported in the States. So it's somewhat limited in that sense. I do have copies of a lot of the Soviet coverage from an assortment of publications that came out at that time and immediately after. But of course, they're all in Russian. I put it all in chronological order. I've kind of superimposed the actual witness reports against the extremely dismissive major media coverage in this on this subject. Also adding into the timeline the fact that Yuri Lizotsev and his research team in December of 1989, they appeared in a nationally broadcast two-hour documentary entitled UFOs in Voronezh, which was completely unknown in this country and completely historic in the Soviet Union. At that time, they introduced the physical evidences that they had gotten even at that early date. Again, it happened in September. The story broke in the West in October. And by December, in a national two-hour broadcast, they were presenting evidence for phosphorus affecting the soil 100 times in excess of that found in control samples in the area, of background radiation counts, the fact that pressure tests on the landing impressions told a tale of a 5 3/4 ton weight that sat there.
Wow.
That the background radiation, that microorganisms were missing in the soil samples that they pulled, that were, you know, control samples taken from 25 feet away or whatever, were alive with microorganisms, as you're going to find almost anywhere in the world. I let the reader, people who have listened to this lecture, draw ultimately their own conclusions. But once again, we see how damning your traditional dismissive Western coverage of the subject can be to people who otherwise might want to learn more about it. It did not help that the beings, the life forms, if you will, or the mechanical accompanying creatures of the life forms were so unusual. In the many years that I worked with Bud in particular, I don't have an actual statistic for it, but I'm going to, off the top of my head, I'll say that maybe 3/4 of the beings that legitimate abductees, legitimate in our minds, certainly after research and investigation, family histories, CAT scans, corroborating information from mental health professionals and medical professionals, that let's say 75% of the life forms that they were reporting were slight variations one way or the other on the archetypical gray, and the other quarter of reports varied wildly, everything from insectoids to reptoids to almost anything imaginable, with the understanding that there's no question in my mind, and it's I think a lot of my colleagues would agree, these intelligences can, if not control, affect human perception and put something in our mind that is not there, perhaps because we cannot tolerate what we're actually seeing, and it is their way of giving us sort of an out. A perfect example is reports on and off over the decades have come in from somebody with a history of the abduction phenomena saying, I saw a white owl on my windowsill and it was 3 or 4 feet tall. Hmm. Well, we can safely dismiss that as a realistic possibility. There are no white owls that are 3 or 4 feet tall. However, whether or not that was a function, they're seeing it, was a function of something that was put in their mind, what we call a screen memory, or a function of their own physiological shock and denial and the human mind's ability to create an image that is more acceptable until you can wrap your head around what you really saw, perhaps at a later date.
Right, right. And do you think that what they were seeing, the 9-foot being and then the smaller one, do you think they were considering them all robots or just the smaller one?
The smaller one was the one that almost every witness described as robot or robot-like. The other ones, including the one that had a humanoid form, torso, arms, legs, but just the tiniest little, you know, in blip up here to suggest a head, that my best sense from the descriptions I've read is that they were, you know, actual creatures of some sort or another, android or bio-android or biological or what have you. Again, when we get into this realm, the only thing we really have is informed speculation. Anybody that says that they know is somebody, I think, to smile and back away from slowly.
Now, the question in the chat room, did the robots or figures, I guess, give off a fear response in the humans? I mean, were people really scared?
If they were, they weren't shrieking and running away. People were standing their ground. They were observing. In 1989, in the Soviet Union, very few people would have been out and about with a camera. Yeah. Overall, that was a luxury item, and hence there are no photos. Mm-hmm. That may seem almost impossible to somebody growing up in the age of, you know, smartphone selfies, but that's the way it was. But not really.
Okay, and also another question. Was there another landing close by there, or any other landings known that were related to that?
Yes, there was another one in the same area within the same time frame. And I'm working off the top of my head here, but let me see if I can find a reference to it, bring up some notes here.
And while you're doing that, I'll make you multitask. So this being, if I remember right, it had like what appeared to be three eyes. Two eyes and then something above it in the center. And is that where the beam came out of? Is one of the eyes, possibly?
Certainly, yeah. By one of the accounts that I researched. And again, I'm just trying to see if I can come right on that account. Okay. Let me give you a couple of facts about it, or the closest thing we have. First, that the UFO first appeared at about 6:30 p.m. Red light descended toward the ground. The light took on the appearance of a spherical or egg-like shape. By some accounts, it circled the immediate area, agitating the grass for about 40 feet below it. It then flew off and returned a few minutes later and hovered over the park. A hatch was seen to open, or a door, call it what you will, in the lower half of the object, and the UFO with the open hatch came to settle down into a good-sized poplar tree, causing the tree to bend under its weight. Now, child and adult witnesses all pretty much agreed that the diameter, and again, we're dealing with young people who might be harder-pressed to estimate a size at an appreciable distance, but they came in at between 30 and 45 feet diameter. The tallest one, one account I have here was in excess of 10 feet by most accounts, not 9 feet. And that was the one that wore a silvery suit with a very small head, not much more than a bump peeking above its whatever it was wearing. It climbed out of the spacecraft. I mean, imagine, climbed down the tree, as did the small robot-like entity or entities, depending on the account. A luminous rectangle appeared under them when they stepped on the ground. It disappeared when the taller one made a sound. The being touched some knobs on the robot's chest as the two began to move about the park. As they progressed through the park, a nearby boy shouted something, possibly in fear. This would have been the only account of somebody screaming that we have in the case, or having a fear sound reaction, causing the being to stare at the child as a beam of light came from its center eye. This seemingly paralyzed boy remained motionless until the tall one looked away. The tall one then climbed up into the tree and into the craft to retrieve a pistol-like device, which was then aimed at the boy. Then aimed at another individual, a young man walking in the vicinity, and witnesses maintain that he then disappeared as the device was trained on him, and reappeared only after the beings and craft departed. I mean, this is arguably wild stuff.
It is.
But this is what we have. And to dismiss it, just because, even for research specialists like myself and a lot of my colleagues, is maybe a way of not taking responsibility for, you know, one more anomaly in the thing. I mean, I think about Bud Hopkins used to have a wonderful thing on his wall. I think it was from National Geographic, and it showed pictures of a young Eskimo boy, a very old Chinese man, animist kind of witch doctor from deep in the South American forests, a Scandinavian woman, and on and on and on, a very black African person down the pantheon, and saying, you know, how can these all be from the same species?
Well, that's it for the free part of the show. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with Kevin Goodman. We're going to be talking about Warmminster UFOs. Remember, you can support the show and listen to the full shows for only $2 or more per month, plus all the archives. And that's a lot of listening. Thanks so much, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.